Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the cork in my bottle. That's a cracker. It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, Dave, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm cold at the moment, I'll be honest with you. I'm cold, it's chilly, it's Long John's weather, but other than that, I'm all right. Did I tell you, by the way, on the school run yesterday, -8.5 Celsius.
Mate, you do love a temperature stat. You want to get out a bit more, mate?
I do. And do you know what? And we won't bring up temperature with our guest because I think we've got far more important things to talk to him about.
We certainly do. And our guest today is a racing driver, a broadcaster, an author, a pundit, and even a musician, you know. Mm-hmm. We're talking motor racing royalty. It is, of course, the one and only and a genuine pal, Mr. Damon Hill. Hello, mate.
On your knees, Jason. This is what you
don't. Don't you worry, I am. On your knees.
Royalty.
I'd say motor racing royalty.
Well, thank you very much for that fantastic introduction. And where can I go from there, other than ruin my reputation and destroy the impression you have in my mind or your mind?
Well, I can kick you off with the start of a 10 if you wish. So anyway, let's start at the beginning then, mate. And the obvious question is, the first question, whatever happened to the hormones?
Yeah, well, the hormones, they never really existed.
Really?
True story. Well, we did some gigs, but let's be honest, we weren't. I think if you're a golfer and you get paid for something, you're a professional golfer. And we never got paid for anything, so I don't think it really counted as a band. It was a school thing, and it came about in because what Jason's referring to is a school band I was in, and there was another part to the name which we'll forget for the moment.
An unbroadcastable part of the name.
Yeah, and it was also deeply offensive. But of course, that was the nature of the game in those days. It was you just copied what the Sex Pistol did, didn't you? You just sort of went, okay, well, they seem to be getting away with it and upsetting everyone and getting noticed. And so that's what we did. We made loud noise with a bunch of friends of mine, and well, there's only three actually. So I think we might have had a fourth, but they weren't very regular. So we basically, I think we were a three piece, and we sort of played parties and stuff like that. But basically, rubbish punk band. But they never went on to do anything. So had a go,
but it didn't. It didn't end there, though, because the fact that I love in the research for this is the fact that you appeared as a guitarist on the Def Leppard album Euphoria. Many people, I believe, don't know that.
No, that is a fact. But I'm quite proud of that one, actually, to be honest, because you can actually hear my guitar as they fade out towards the end of the song. It was on the Euphoria album, and the track is called Demolition Man, appropriate for a racing driver. And I was asked. What happened was, I lived in Ireland, and in Ireland there was a lot of musicians, including, of course, Def Leppard. And Joe Elliott said to me at a party once, he said, "Oh, we're recording up the road, and you should come and play on our album." And so I basically challenged him to accept that, or to live up to his offer. So I literally turned up on the doorstep and said, "Okay, I'm here. I've got my guitar. Come on, then." So they put me down in the basement, and they had a recording session. They went, "Right, have a go at that." And I did an okay, reasonable job, and it's actually, I think it fits well with the track. Yeah. Wow. So and it went platinum. It went platinum.
Did it really?
Somewhere out there is a platinum disc. They brought it over to give it to me, but I couldn't manage to get to meet up with them. So I think they left it in the hotel.
I love that. And so obviously, sort of with the music side of things, presumably you've had a jam session or two with the likes of Eddie Jordan over the years.
Well, Eddie,
and,
of course.
Motor racing.
Yeah. So Eddie,
he loves it, doesn't he?
Yeah. And he famously came up with the idea of getting a flatbed truck and getting all his relatives over from Ireland and having a party after this Grand Prix. And literally it was, you know, his cousin Dave and his uncle, whoever it was, you know. And so they all came over and had a great time. And we all ended up on stage afterwards. And, you know, Johnny Herbert on triangle, David Caldwell on tambourine. And we just were, you know, we'd had a fantastic weekend and a few beers, and off we went, and Eddie on drums.
Do you know what? The paddocks, they're not the same, are they, nowadays?
Well, no, it all got, as these things do, it all got out of hand, and now it's like a, you know, full-on kind of Nebworth kind of, operation, Isle of Wight Festival. But, yeah, in those days, it literally was impromptu, completely off the cuff, and just, and it was grass as well. Don't forget, it was, you know, so before they tarmacked over the massive, the field that was Silverstone. And so,
and are you still playing a bit now?
I've got a guitar in my room, in this very room that I'm talking to you from now. So I've got a couple of guitars, and I, every now and then I pick them up and I plunk away and I kind of try to remember what I, you know, forgotten. And, but the fingers don't do what they're supposed to do anymore. You know, it's, you have to keep playing all the time.
Yeah.
And it, otherwise they just go, they go all sort of stumpy and useless, and you're kind of playing four strings instead of one, and it's horrible. But
did you play any instruments, Dave?
Well, my dad was a jazz musician. My dad was a pro musician, so I he was a drummer. I play a bit of drums. I used to play the violin as a kid and then gave that up, then played the clarinet as a kid and gave that up, and now I don't really do anything. Wow. But I like to sort of think of myself as loosely musical. Likewise, when I was at school, I formed a little band. I think we had one gig. We were called The Bland, which is a really rubbish name now, looking back on it. Three piece, and basically just doing Jimi Hendrix covers, because the guy that sang was mad on Hendrix. So I remember sort of doing this gig and just basically playing old Hendrix things. But it was short lived, and I don't think we ever had another gig.
I saw a documentary the other night about, you remember the film Rainbow Bridge that Jimi Hendrix was in? It's a film about the making of that documentary. It's absolutely brilliant. Right. I can't remember what channel it was on, but it was really fascinating. And great stuff about Jimi Hendrix in those days. I mean, he got roped into doing this and he didn't want to be there. It was absolutely bonkers.
Yeah.
It was up a mountain. Yeah. It was like, it's in Hawaii. I think it was on one of those volcanoes. So it was about 5,000 feet up or something, and blowing a gale, and all these people turned up out of nowhere to go to this Jimi Hendrix concert. And then the guy who put it together was, he went off the rails, and the all the stuff ended up on the editing. You know, great story. But anyway, Jimi Hendrix, there was also some great guitar work from Jimmy there. Well done you for.
He's brilliant. Yeah. Thank you, Jason. Have you ever? I mean, you know, you strike us as being a natural performer. I know that there was talk at one point about you being on stage with Ricky Wilson from Kaiser Chiefs. Have you ever sort of demonstrated your frontman skills?
No, I haven't. I used to, and this isn't a euphemism, I used to play the organ, you know, as a kid, you know, the Bontempi organ you'd have. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I found motor racing, so everything that wasn't a tyre went in the bin and wasn't put on the Christmas list. Mm. I'm desperate to do that little. Damon, Ricky Wilson.
You don't sing, Jason.
Kaiser Chiefs.
You've got a great voice. You know, you've got a sort of gravelly voice. I'm sure you could know, do some screeching or something, heavy metal. No?
Well, the punk era would have suited me well. A bit absolutely. Of shouting and carrying on, a bit of smashing.
Yeah, a bit of smashing. that's what it's all about. You know, you've got to remember to finish your set first before you destroy your instruments, because otherwise the audience get very upset.
Yes. I have been known to damage my tools before the end.
Well, we managed to get organ and tools in there. So well done.
Absolutely. In terms of you two, obviously you go back many, many years. What was the point where you first met?
Well, I can remember seeing a guy called Plato going down the back straight at Snetterton in a Formula First. And I remember thinking, that was you, wasn't it?
No.
It wasn't.
It was a Formula Renault.
It was a Formula Renault. Okay, right. Yes. I forgot the car, but I remember the name.
But,
I remember just thinking, great name. And how did you get this name? Plato, because I mean, it is like, you know, it's
a bonkers name, isn't it?
It's a very famous name, and it does it carries a lot of baggage.
It certainly does. Yes,
it's a weight of expectation, I think, isn't there, with a name like
seriously?
Yeah,
I mean, what happened to the Republic?
Yeah. Well, that's a book which is in there, and I'm still not through it. But I mean, you know, the old man Plato, he did come up with some great quotes. What one was? It was a.
Your man or the other old
the really old man.
No, the really, really old bloke. And he said, one of his quotes was, it was a wise man, he who invented beer, was a Plato quote, apparently.
Genius.
Yeah.
So that's an entire
philosophy. And a whole load of other really deep stuff he was, attribute to the man.
Yeah. So just to answer you, Dave, the truth is, you were slightly behind year wise, weren't you? So it's like I was in year, yes. I was like a sixth form and you were like in the fourth form or something, weren't you? So,
yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly like that. Yeah.
And so basically our car paths did not cross as far as I'm aware. So,
no, well, in terms of competing against each other. I mean, no. We might have shared a paddock, but even then, probably not.
Were you in... I did Ford Cosworth Sierra at Donington once. Were you in that one? It was a British touring car too. No, maybe it's before you even got there then.
I mean, I didn't... Yeah. I joined Williams at the end of your magnificent championship winning year. So at the end of 96, 97 being my first season with Renault. But I can remember first chatting to you would have been a corporate charity karting do. Might even been Johnny's gig. You know, he used to do that gig near Christmas down in the East End of London.
Yeah.
A karting thing. And I just signed for Willys. And obviously we were in the same sort of team, weren't we? We had the same unusual man
as
a boss.
Head as well.
Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Patrick seemed to be inordinately interested in the touring car project. Where's he going now? What's he doing over there? But anyway, it's a new
upsetting,
thing.
Upsetting everybody. I can remember, you'll appreciate this, Damon, but my first year at Williams, as you can imagine, coming from where I'd come from to join such a team like that, it was a big moment for me. And I can remember being at Alton Park and Patrick said, right, come on, I want to come out and I want to have a look at some of the corners. So we jumped on the little golf buggy and shot down there. And he got out with a packed, Sunday crowd. And it was in between our races down at Cascades. And he got out and he went, oh, right, this is where the great unwashed live then, is it?
Yes.
I'm like, oh, God, Patrick, get back in. Get back in. And then, oh, look at these people.
Civilians.
But you know what he's like? He's a character, isn't he?
Yeah, no, he wouldn't be ashamed of saying what he thought. But, and that's part of his charm and part of his attraction, honestly, you know. So he didn't offend anybody. He was just speaking. Mm. Yeah, speaking of, well.
Just Patrick. Yeah. Just Patrick.
Just being Patrick. Himself.
Yeah. Obviously, motor racing has been in the blood. Mm. What's your earliest memory?
Do you know something?
Motor racing?
Somebody sent me a picture of some kind of... It was like a go-kart, but it had bodywork on it, made of tin, I think. And they said, did your dad buy this for you? And I'm thinking, it sort of rang a bell. It looked familiar, but he definitely didn't buy me anything motorized when I was a kid. But I do remember, I remember my dad, was a racer.
Yes.
So as we speak, he hadn't yet sewn up the Formula One World Championship of 1962. So I was born in 1960 September. So I was just over a year old, and he was in South Africa. He went off to South Africa, and actually the last race was the 29th of December. So it's after Christmas. So they had the championship hadn't been decided yet, but 60 years ago, as we speak. So I grew up into the world of having a father who was a racing driver. So when were you conscious of what was going on around you, Jason? Five years old, 4 years old? Anyway,
I guess.
At some point or other, there's a picture of me at my christening, which my dad invited a load of people to in 61. And there is Taffy Von Trips and Tony Brooks, Joe Bonnier, Bruce McLaren, Stirling Moss, and my dad. And, and I was surrounded by these chaps and the fact that my dad was a racing driver and my mum would have taken us to the track. So I can't honestly say at what point I was aware of cars, as a thing, because they just seem like the normal world to me. But I mentioned this go-kart. I mean, there was a point where I kind of must have been conscious my dad was a racing driver. And then someone said, do you want to have a go in a go-kart? And I had a go in a go-kart. I didn't know what to do with it. And I think I went to Rye House when I must have been about five or six, and they put me on there was a little mini track, baby track.
Yep.
And I think it went round there, and I think it was covered in grime and grease and stuff. And I think I spun it about six times and then just got dirty. And I wasn't really attracted to it for some reason. I was, so it kind of washed over me in an odd way. But then as time goes by, you know, you become more conscious and you got aware of, you know, the things that happen. I mean, I remember my dad. So I would have been five when he won the Indy 500. And so he had a party in the back garden and there's Jim Clark and my dad and stuff.
It's just wonderful.
So, it was all around us all the time. And I've got a picture I drew of my dad's. It must have been about 1960. I would have been 6 years old. And there's a, you know, like you do these pictures for school of what your dad does. So I've got a picture. Yeah. There's a picture of my dad in his Dunlop overalls. And in the background, there's a red transporter with a red car coming out of it and a green transporter with a yellow stripe on it, which was obviously a Lotus.
Wow. But it was bikes, though, wasn't it, first for you, Damon? I mean, obviously, you started through the karting route like arguably most racing drivers do at some point in their childhood. But then what was the transition into bikes and how did that manifest itself?
I wasn't really aware of motorbike. I mean, I used to watch motocross on telly. I can remember that distinctly. And I remember watching
Kickstart?
Jeff Banks. No, that was going back way before then. This is the original. It was called Scrambling. And Murray Walker commentated on it. And it was bikes in a muddy field. And they were going...
Yep.
that's a hell of an expression.
Okay,
that's impression rather. That's incredible. I was there.
Exactly. So that's the noise, and then there's these guys getting covered in mud, falling off, and then there's Murray Walker commentating in it, and he's going. Mm. And if you look closer, you can see Banks is coming through, and he's going in, and you're trying to work out. They all look the same because they're all covered in mud. You can't see any numbers or anything. You've got no idea what's going on. But I remember being excited by that, and then later on, this is. Absolutely unbelievable, this story, because there were two guys. I'd be taken to Silverstone and we'd be plopped in the doghouse that was the place where all the wives and girlfriends went and left their coats and also made sandwiches and cakes. So kids go there and then you kind of go, I can't stay in here all day. So you go out wandering around the paddock, just kicking your heels. And there were these two blokes and they were called the Shevlovs brothers. And there was, and they had a little monkey bike. They had a little motorbike, which was the little frame, you know, the Honda one, the very first. And I saw them on this riding this bike around, and obviously I was part of my brain's going, that looks fun. And they must have had, can I have a go written on my face or something? Because they let me have a go. And I remember getting on it. And I used to ride around on my bicycle at home in Mill Hill. We used to go off with my mates and, you know, we just go on adventures on our bicycles. So being on two wheels, I kind of,
was the natural
understood.
Yeah,
this thing you didn't have to pedal it. You just needed to turn the little thing on the handlebar, and off it went. And it was like massive light bulb moment goes off. And I do wonder about that because my dad actually started off on motorbikes. He also did scrambling and broke his leg quite badly. So he had a bad limp because of a crash on a motorbike. Mm-hmm. And my grandma rode a motorbike. So I've got a picture of my grandma in between the walls wearing jodhpurs, kind of like, you know, like those flying trousers. You see the guy coming out there. She's got those kind of like baggy trousers and massive leather gauntlets and goggles on a motorbike. And that's so, you know, after the First World War, women did all the jobs and they rode motorbikes. But my granddad, in other words, my dad's dad, never drove a car in his life. So
is that right? Really?
Never drove a car in his life. Didn't have a driving license. So, it, you know, I do think that my grandma, my dad's mum, unconsciously all that stuff, you know, the kind of whatever it is, the passing on some experience through genetics. I honestly think it must have come from her.
Wow, how brilliant is that?
Because I remember getting on this motorbike, going, twisting the thing and off I went. And I just thought, and then I pestered my dad. I said, Dad, can I have a motorbike? No. I didn't know how much they cost, you know. It's like I knew they probably weren't cheap, but and so so that's how it all started. I basically learned more but it was the experience. So not motivated by seeing a famous person. Eventually I saw Barry Sheen and, you know, and Agostini all those people and I wanted, I just realized they were my heroes, you know, guys on motorbikes.
Because you did some racing, didn't you? You did some bike racing.
Absolutely. No, I was champion of brands one year. I won every race I did. I used to do three races in a day. And I cracked the winning thing. You know, Jason, it's like when you win your first, you go into, I don't know, did you win your first ever race? Probably. I don't know. Did you?
No, I didn't. No.
So you race and you're doing it. And then one day you kind of win something.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you're out there. And
I'm actually quite good at this.
Yeah.
Well, it's like something unlocks.
Something unlocks completely because up until that point, you've been following the guys in front. And then suddenly there's no one in front. And you're going, now what?
And your ears start being really sensitive to noises and stuff.
Yeah, and you start thinking, there's another little voice that comes in your head, which is, what are you doing here? And why are you, where have they all gone? Don't look over your shoulder. Just keep doing it until they see the checker flag. And basically from that point onwards, I won a lot of races. And actually that happened roughly the same time I took up car racing, or my mum met a person who said he ought to get off that bike and try cars because he's going to hurt himself.
Is that when you went to Winfield?
Safety reasons.
Yeah, I think.
Because I went to Winfield. Now, obviously, we know the lovely Mike Knight.
Yes, completely. So Mike was very important because he'd actually was one of the people who spoke to Mum and said he wanted. We just lost Tombay, haven't we? Patch Tombay.
Yes.
Patch Tombay was one of the French crew who went through the Winfield school. Renault, Elf, Winfield. So it's got these two French names and an English name. Why is it called Winfield? But anyway, that was the racing school that had the deal for all the French drivers. If you did well in that, you get sponsored to do Formula Renault free. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so all the Carters went there, won the scholarship, and got Formula Renault, Formula 3, Formula 1.
Yep.
Alain Prost, Jack Lafitte, Patrick Tombay, René Arnoux, all the French crew came through that school. And so they wanted to see if they could get an English guy to win it, which was a bit of a stupid idea because obviously the French weren't going to go for that. So
anyway. I can vouch for that.
So anyway, having had some experience, they're very proud of their nation and everything. So, but anyway, along comes English guy. And so I did very well, but I didn't win the school. And I think Mike Knight noted I got something. And he kind of, I think he was the first person to sort of say, well, you know, you could be good if you didn't cock up the final like you just did, you know. So, that was that was how I got off the two wheels and onto four wheels. And I have to say, I didn't like it at first. I just didn't like being strapped into a cockpit. I just, you know, it felt very claustrophobic. And a car didn't accelerate like a motorbike did. It's not
new.
You know, no oomph. And of course, that's the point. Until you get more power, you can't drive it like a motorbike, because a motorbike's got way more power than the contact patch. And so it wasn't until you get more power in a racing car, or it was wet, that I could actually do something with the damn thing, because they're like a dead weight. You know, Formula Ford's got no oomph at all. It's just rattles, you know.
And the other thing as well, during this whole sort of process, and again, many people possibly don't realize this and just sort of assume that you graduate up and someone says, drive for us. But you're having to secure funding all the way through this, aren't you? Which I guess is your sort of primary role. Is that fair to say that you've got to be sort of finding funding to enable you to have these rides or these drives? And then you've got to work spare jobs and you're working as a laborer and a courier. And it's quite a lot of graft behind the scenes, isn't there?
When my dad died, then I was 15, and then I carried on with school, and then I basically realized I've got to get some money in. And my ambition was to support myself in a racing bike. So I used to try and find money to go racing bikes. But you could, if you could just about afford to own your own bike, run your own bike, and work and pay for it all yourself, and you know, with a bit of prize money, you could actually race at a national level. In the UK. But car racing, I mean, Formula Ford was, I don't know, what it was, £70,000 or something back in 1984. You're going, what? And Formula 3 was £150,000. You buy a house for that? What are you talking about? How are you going to spend that in 1 year? How am I going to? So my getting sponsorship was not my strong point, because I'd literally sit there in a meeting with someone and go, I have absolutely no idea how you're going to make this money back or why anyone would do it in the right mind. So, I wasn't a very good salesman.
Yeah. If I was you, I wouldn't do it.
Taxi!
Exactly. So I never really got the money to go. I was rubbish at that bit. Unfortunately, I did have some very kindly people who thought it'd be worth, you know, giving me a crack. So I got some money in for a couple of seasons or a season of Formula 3, but then I owed the money back. And now I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, what have I done? You know, and now these people are out there and I haven't paid them back and I don't know how I'm going to pay them back. And then a lifeline came, which was the Cellnet. So David Hunt, James's brother, I put together this. So he was good at selling, right? He was brilliant. Yeah. He had a marketing brain. So he came up with the Cellnet deal, which was imagine a time when there were no mobile phones. What is a mobile phone? Nobody knew, right? This was 1985, 86. And he'd done a deal with Cellnet, who were there was only two mobile phone providers in those days. One was Vodafone and the other one was Cellnet, so Cellnet becomes O2 eventually. But long story short, there's this deal and it was perfect for their market. They didn't want to go to F1. They just wanted to be in the UK. And they had a little Formula 3 team. And they offered a deal with drivers to provide everyone with, £5,000 and also a phone that you could phone, do as many phone calls as you like for free. So we're all going, what? You know, and David Hunt's going, you sign this thing. And if you get to F1, they have to pay you £100,000. And everyone, they're thinking no one's going to get to F1, right? So, so I signed.
Is that right? Wow. Yeah.
So it had this kind of grading, it had this thing, the further up you went, the more they had to cough up.
Yeah.
Plus the free phones and blah, blah. Yeah. But, the free phone calls were a godsend because you could do all your marketing. You could, you know, phone people for sponsorship. It didn't cost you anything.
So of course. Yeah. Do the phone bashing.
Yeah. And I remember, so this is how early a day, earlier time it was in the whole communications business. I went on a trip with some friends to Wales. We used to muck about on motorbikes and I was on my way back with this guy from New Zealand who was a carpenter. Mm. And we're driving back and he's saying, what's that? We're on the M4, just gone past Bristol. And he said, what's that? I said, that's my mobile phone. He said, what's a mobile phone? I said, you can phone anywhere you like in the world. He said, I can phone my mum. I was like, you can phone your mum. Yeah. Why don't you phone your mum? Right? So, he's on the mic. I said, well, what time is it in New Zealand? He says, it doesn't matter. I'm going to phone her. So he phones his mum in New Zealand. So it must have been about 3 a.m. His poor mum gets a phone call from the other side of the world and is Dave on the line going, mum, you'll never believe it. I'm on a motorway talking to you on a mobile phone. And she said, that's great, son. What's a motorway?
No way.
She did. She's like,
good Lord.
They don't have motorways in New Zealand. But I'm sorry to all the New Zealand listeners. I know you do have probably call them freeways. But anyway, so she was.
How cool is that? And do you know what? That's not that long ago, is it? That's late 80s.
It's
what,
a long
88?
Time ago now, Jason.
How
many years is that? 40?
But that's the thing, though, isn't it? You know, we fall into this trap quite a lot, whereby in our own mind, we kind of think, well, sort of 10 years ago was 1995. Was 1985. Completely. And it's like, no, it's like 30s and 40 years ago.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Well, anyway, children, there was a time when we didn't have mobile phones, let alone smartphones. So. And in fact, the iPhone is only it's less than 15 years old, isn't it now?
Yeah.
Yeah, 2006 or 2007, I think, wasn't it? Something like that,
That's how crazy
something
it is.
Of that order. Yeah, absolutely. Within that whole process then, I mean, you know, did you find, I know obviously, you know, the Cellnet thing was a breakthrough, but were there points before that where you genuinely had to consider whether this was a brick wall in front of you and that you might not be able to continue your path on the motor racing career and you might have to come out and get a normal job? I mean, that must have... Was that a real consideration?
Yeah, absolutely. I ran out, but by 89, I'd run out of, I had this, as I said, this lifeline with the Cellnet deal. And eventually it kind of ran out of steam and they didn't sign me up and I hadn't won enough. And meanwhile, Johnny Herbert and Martin Donnelly had gone on to great things and been signed up in F1. And I'm thinking, I'm left at the altar. And I literally had to kind of reconfigure. Reevaluate and reconfigure my life because I'd just got married. We've had our first son, Oliver, who had Down syndrome. I'd bought a house. We had a mortgage. It was, mortgage rates were 17%. And I hadn't got anything to drive. So I literally thought, well, is either give up or adopt a different approach, which was I'll only do it if I get paid.
Yeah.
Which was a bit of a turn. I'm not going to find the money. And so, and out of the blue came a couple of opportunities. When I mentioned the touring car thing, I think it was, it was an opportunity that came up. And I said, well, I'll do it if I get paid. Which, how much you want? 500 quid. And literally, it was like, I've got a mortgage. I'm never going to get, you know, I'm going to have to do a lot of races for 500 quid. Anyway, you know, but I just doubled down. I just went, okay, I'm going to have to be more focused. I've got responsibilities. I'm going to have to. So I think I changed my approach to racing, which was I am not here to muck about. I have to win. I have to. So, and then I got a drive at Le Mans and I think I got paid. Might have been a couple of grand for that, actually. I don't know. But, you know, going with Richard Lloyd. Sean Walker was the guy who I was racing with in the touring car. Oh my God, I had the most massive tank slapper in that at Cosworth Sierra, Jason. Honestly, well, you know, they got 500 horsepower, haven't they, those things?
Yes.
Coming out of McLean's. And I remember I remember just going, it just went boing, it went full whack one way, and then kind of gripped and then sprung back the other way. And it had this huge steering wheel on it like this. And I remember just going, my arms sort of go flying around trying to keep this thing to go straight. Oh my God.
Mine yours.
But it was all living on your wits. And then Le Mans, literally I had no practice. They sent me out. I went up and down an airfield once or twice to know where the knobs and buttons were. And then they basically sent me out in the stint in the middle of the race. Literally, and I got another tank slapper going onto the Mulsanne straight in a Porsche 9, whatever it was, which we
956.
Yeah, because you drive it like you know, Formula 3 car or whatever it is, and you, they're a bit heavier. But anyway.
Wow.
So
what catalyzed, you know, your first jump into F1 then with, you know, as a test driver with Willys?
So that led, that was 1989. So from that, at the end of the year, there was a really bad Formula 3000 car called a Footwork, and it had a Mugen Honda engine in it.
Yes.
And nobody wanted to drive it because it was so bad. And so me and Perry put our hands up and went, we'll do it, you know, anything. All right, so I got into a shootout with Perry at a test, and they gave the drive to me because I think Perry fell out with the engineer. And I remember thinking that wasn't a very clever thing to do, pal. You know, but anyway, he didn't like the engineer. I thought, I like anybody to do with this team. And they were going to pay me. So they paid me. So I managed to scrape this crate into races. And from that, another team in Formula 3000 called Middlebridge thought, well, we'll give him a go. Looks like he's quite handy. Mm. And that car turned out to be a flyer. It was the Lola, whatever it was, T, whatever. And it had a Tickford engine and it was quick, but it just kept breaking down. So I got three pole positions and your support race to a Formula One race. And Patrick Head thought, well, you know, he's doing quite well and he's British, you know, sort of thing. I don't know what he thought. But anyway, so I got, and then Mark Blundell had the Williams test drive and he decided the grass was greener over at McLaren. So off he went and left this drive available and actually gave me the nod, said, I'm off over there. If you fancy that, you should speak to Williams. So I spoke to Williams. I hope he's not listening because he'll want 20% or something. But, so he went, I got the Williams test drive. And so literally one mighty leap, I went from being no job, mortgage, handicapped child, married, no job, to being a test driver for Williams. And then all it took was for Nigel Mansell to suddenly decide he didn't want to race for Williams, and suddenly I'm in the bloody seat with Alan Prost.
Yeah.
Can I ask a potentially silly question? In terms of, you know, we sort of hear and talk about test drivers all the time. Is being a test driver effectively being the understudy?
Yeah.
If we were to use the theatrical, you know.
Yeah,
that's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, you're a bit of a vulture. You're sitting there on the branch hoping that someone slips on a banana skin, you know. And I mean, obviously you don't wish that. But the point is, you're right. If somebody gets COVID and they can't drive, you're in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's it. In you go. And so, but it wasn't, I was the first, at that time, it was seen as a dead end job. It was basically, if you get a test, if you're a test driver, you're a failed racing driver. And
okay.
So I really was the first guy to convert, I think, that I'm sure historians will pick me up on this, but I think it became after that a sought after job to be a test driver or reserve. They weren't called reserve drivers. They were just called test drivers.
Sorry.
So you weren't the reserve. You literally just were the test driver.
Yeah.
But
you're waiting there in the wings, aren't you? Literally, I guess, you know, should anything happen and a position become available, you're the first person that's going to be in.
Well, the thing that was slightly odd in my case was that I worked on the active car. And so I was one of the very, very few people who had experience of these strange beasts. I think that's why I got the gig, because I was familiar and I knew the engineers and I knew how it worked and I knew how to drive it, and other people would have to kind of get used to it. So
yeah, because back in those days, Williams were the absolute pioneers of active ride, weren't they?
Yes. Well, there was a few other people who'd had a go. Lotus had tried to do one, but it was a fully active car. In other words, they were trying to control the platform using computing power entirely, and so the positions of the suspension would be dictated by feedback to the computer, and if that went wrong, of course it just, and I remember watching at Snetterton, I can remember watching Nakajima, who had been given the job of test driver. I think Nigel had said, I'm not driving that, or Peaky had said, you're never getting me in that thing, forget it. And it literally used to sit in the garage and it would start shimmying. At first, it would just be a little shiver, and then after it just got completely uncontrollable shakes, like a washing machine that kind of got too much laundry in one side. It was absolutely insane. So I think most of them just thought, So the Williams system was slightly simpler. So they simplified the idea, and they made it something that was more of a controlled platform rather than trying to control every single little bump of the car.
Mm.
Yeah, amazing technology. Have you seen some demonstrations of it, Dave?
No. I mean, I've heard of it. I've heard of it, but I've never. You know, obviously, I've assumed it was obviously something to do with the suspension, hence the name. But I don't know anything about how it works.
It's quite extraordinary. I mean, you know, it sits its bum down the straight to take rear wing off. It tilts itself into corners.
You could do
it
all
reads
that.
Bumps.
Yeah,
it, you know, it
and
reads
no
bumps.
One else was doing that at the time then.
They tried. I think Williams cracked the first one and kind of all said they'd gone down a sensible. This is where Patrick is brilliant, because Patrick would say, okay, it has to work. It has to. It's no good coming up with some brilliant idea if it's going to be a nightmare to sort out. We want something that fundamentally is not too complicated, but does the job of what we're trying to achieve, which is to control the ride height. And the ride height, as we know, is where all the downforce comes from. So the height of the car and the attitude of the floor, the flat floor, is what gives it the most amazing amount of downforce. It's a ground effect.
I have a question for you, Damon, which is potentially, you know, a difficult one to answer, but I'm going to try it anyway. Obviously, over your career, you've raced against, you know, the best of the best all the way through, and you've had a remarkable career. Who would you say was your greatest ever opponent? If that's not too difficult a question to answer,
I would say I was teammates with Martin Donnelly, and I think Martin taught me how much better I'd have to be if I wanted to be any good.
Okay,
yeah. So he was a tough nut to crack, and he was, you know, super fast, super talented, and it's a real shocker what happened. I wasn't really in the same team with Johnny, but Johnny again had natural talent in abundance. So of my contemporaries, they were two of the, the most impressive, I'd say. And then, of course, you know, racing against Michael Schumacher in a championship, to go up against someone like Michael Schumacher in a Formula One World Championship, is, it makes you realize yet again what the consequences are of not being as good as someone like that, because you're the first loser. You're the guy that you're supposed to, you're the one in the ring with him, and you're getting bashed all over the place. And it's not much fun. You know, everyone else can stay in the, they can stay behind in the shadows a little bit because they're not actually going head to head. But of course,
I was, there's nowhere to hide, is there?
Nowhere to hide. You're the guy that's supposed to stop him. And of course, at that time, he hadn't won a world championship when I first raced with him. So he was, everyone knew he was good, but they didn't know quite where he was going to end up and where he was going. But he could do things with a racing car that just mere mortals couldn't do, like Ayrton, you know. Ayrton was it was freakily fast as well. And they're all good, you know, Nigel, you know, Adam Prost, you know, they are another level. They can keep that up, you know, lap after lap, race after race, year after year. And I would say, you know, in my defense, I was a late developer, so I hadn't had my F1 experience in my 20s. I only just got there when I was in my 30s, so I was really kind of trying to catch up a little bit. But, you know, I couldn't maintain that pace and that level of ability that they could forever. You know, I'd have my moments, and if I could raise my game to match them, but to be there all the time persistently was quite hard work.
Can I ask you about Ayrton briefly? In so much as obviously, you know, his death shocked the world, not just motor racing. I think it shocked the world generally. When you are driving at the same time and you're a colleague and an opponent of his, does it make you again reevaluate what you're doing? Does it bring into sharp focus exactly how dangerous motor racing is?
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, I think everyone puts bad things out of their mind. You know, we can't go through life if we think about all the awful things that could happen. So in the same with motor racing, you get in the car and you kind of go, right, well, I've thought about what the odds are, and they're somewhere lurking around in the background, and they're not, you know, they're acceptable. It's an acceptable level of risk.
Yeah.
You say to yourself, and then of course something happens and you kind of go, ooh, you know, that's not so, that's a bit too close for comfort.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of, you're, gambler's brain starts kicking in and goes, well, wait a minute, then what's the chances of, how many times has that happened, and how many times per season is that going to happen, and what's the chance of that happened to me? You know, there's 19 other guys, and you know, you start doing those sort of calculations, and you start going back to where you started, which is, on balance, I'll take the chance. And that's exactly the same calculation that every driver has done, even those that got killed. But we can't ask them, you know, we can't ask those guys,
yeah,
is it worth it? And so the whole sport did after Imola. They said, do I want to be involved in this? And I've been in teams where, even in Formula 3, you know, with Dick Bennett and Bertrand Farby. I was there when we were testing at Goodwood. And he just said, I don't know if I want to do this. So he went off and actually ended up doing touring cars after that. He stopped doing single-seaters. And I think if you look at any of the films, like the one that Jackie has just done for his Race Against Dementia, where it's actually his son, Mark, has done it. And it is about the era that Jackie was racing in, where they lost all their mates. You know, and you've got Helen.
Nearly every other weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah. And you've got Helen saying, I don't want to have anything to do with this, you know, in effect, because I don't want to make friends with people if they're going to die. You know? And that was the same with the mechanics. I've heard that also from mechanics. Mechanics would not build up a relationship with a driver because it hurts so much, you know, when they, and that was a grim toll and tally, you know, in our sport. But, and the fact that people kept on getting in a car, and my dad, you know, carried on racing, and losing all his mates, and you must, you know, it's I don't know how they did it. You know, it's one thing to get in those cars and be brave enough to drive around, but actually to be carrying on when you know you've got a 1 in 12 chance of dying. That's that. I don't know what the SOM averages were, but you know, probably not very good. But you know, some people did survive the Battle of the Somme, but You know, you had literally, if you got two guys driving with 24 to 26 starters, so you got 1 in 13 chance of surviving the season. It's not good odds, is it, really?
No,
it's also because you're not just, you know, you're not just driving. It's not just like you're driving around a circuit. You know, you are driving to the absolute limit of the car and to you and everything in order to be competitive and to have that cutting edge. And obviously when you are driving on that limit, then obviously your chances of something, you know, going wrong are increased tenfold, hundredfold.
And the cars were not, you know, with the best will in the world, the mechanics could only do so much, and some cars failed and some cars weren't put together properly by accident. You couldn't just say, you know, carbon fiber has saved my life. It saved my legs. It saved, you know, countless drivers' lives. I can remember going 3,000. I remember going straight into the wall at Mugello at the second Arrabbiata. I remember just going, got it all wrong, went straight off, boom, straight into the wall. I just remember thinking, you're going to smash your legs up. You're not going to have any legs. But somehow that thing is just incredibly strong, you know. And in my case, it didn't break off. But other drivers haven't been so lucky in, you know, places like Indianapolis and the faster super speedways, you know, they, even carbon fiber can't save you. But
I guess if you look at all the shunts that there still are these days with the modern technology we've got, you know, if catapult back in time, 50, 60 years, those would be fatal accidents because of the technology improvement. So it's, you know, there's still shunts, but actually it's a big shunt. You know, you need a really big shunt now or need to be unlucky because of the, you know, the pace of safety development.
Well,
of which you mentioned Jackie, he was a forerunner in that.
Jackie was made himself a target. You know, he's got, let's say you got a chance of winning the world championship and then you make yourself a target for people who don't like what you're saying. You know, you're jeopardizing your chances of winning that championship. And I can remember, you know, occasions when you want to challenge authority and part of your brain's going, except I don't want them to, you know, exact their revenge on me halfway through this championship I'm trying to win. Yeah.
I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you what your favourite circuit is from obviously the Formula One days, but actually more in keeping with where we're going with this conversation, I'm going to change it slightly and say, which is the circuit which scared you the most or gave you the most fear?
I would say Suzuka was the one that I first went to and thought, "Oh my god,
really?"
Yeah, I would say so.
Well, for what reason?
I mean, the Spa in the wet was not much fun. So even in Formula 3, I can remember going there and coming and going, I can't see anything. How can I supposed to do this? I remember sort of coming in and going, but I can't see. And the guys were going, yeah, it's Spa. You know, you can't see where you're going when it's wet. The old Spa really was very scary, even in the dry, because there was no runoff. There was no fencing, nothing. You just went into a field or a woods and stuff.
Or hit a house. I mean, they use people's front gardens as, you know, an extra bit of tarp, you know, that might have been a driveway where they might slide onto the driveway.
Yeah.
I mean, just amazing.
Well, I mean,
just incredible.
But they still do that, don't they, in the Isle of Man? You know, on most, you know, you go to the Isle of Man and you just go, what are you doing? It's bonkers. Ooh. I mean, serious bravery. But in Spa, when my dad went there, the first time he went there, he did one lap, came back in and said, and they said, what, you're right, there's a car, okay? He said, yeah, no, I don't think I can do this. He literally said to the guys, I don't know if I can do it. And they went up to my mum and said, is he all right? He's, and she said, yeah, just leave him for a bit. And then he kind of had a think about it. And then he carried on. But there was a little old lady who was a farmer, and she used to insist on crossing the track to milk her cows. And they kept on saying, can you not do that now? Right in the middle of it. And she said, no, nothing would persuade her. So they'd have to, you know, run the risk of colliding with a milk churn with some little old lady.
Well, I must admit, Dave, just while you shot off a minute ago, I was just having a chat with Darren about the world of simulators, and it wasn't until lockdown came did I get a simulator of home to stop me going out of my mind. Yeah. And that is the one circuit of the era where you can go back and race a 66 Grand Prix at the old Spa. It's the only time I've ever driven or looked at a circuit and gone, no, this is absolutely ridiculous.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Bonkers, bonkers. Mm. But exciting.
Yeah.
And to go back to what we were saying earlier, you know, the drivers were in the cutting edge cars of their time. You know, carbon fiber was 50 years away from being invented.
Or seatbelts.
Or seatbelts. Yeah.
Or face crash helmets. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So they knew no better. And also that they were, you know, doing mental gymnastics all the time you know, competitive, focused drivers with lots of self-belief. Of course they wanted to do it.
I mean, I do think, you know, without going into the COD psychology of it, but I mean, you have to factor in that they just come through a war. So a lot of the guys who raced in the 60s and 50s, they would have known their parents or their brothers or whatever would have been getting into bombers or going into tanks. And, so the idea of doing something for fun and complaining about the risks was
well, it changes it changes your assessment of the risk, doesn't it? I suppose. Yeah, you're absolutely right. In that sort of era where so many people had lost their lives, I guess, your approach to risk is entirely different, because you think, why?
I mean, the guy who people died, one of the last dam busters, just died recently, didn't he? And he was talking about how they had to fly by 30 feet across over this reservoir, and they had to drop the bomb, and basically the bomb had to not bounce up and hit them. That was the one. Basically had to be going, they had to drop it in the right way so it didn't just come straight back at them and blow them into the
boring.
So, you know,
the bomber had two bits of wood with two little posts
scientific
on,
bits of wood.
Exactly. They weren't they? Looking at the bottom at 30 feet doing what? 200 mile an hour?
Not 31 feet, not 29 feet. It had to be 30.
30, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Another question for you then, Damon. Of all the things you've achieved during a remarkable career, what could you pick out as your finest moment or your proudest moment? Is there one? God.
You say things like, you know, and your career, you just do this stuff, don't you? You kind of throw yourself in these situations. You're going to go, right, I don't know how I'm going to cope with this, but I'll give it a go. And that's, you know, so definitely I would say in a driving context, having to win the race in Suzuka against Michael would probably be it, because there was we had to win that. And I just couldn't. I just dragged every last drop of whatever I had out of me and somehow beat Michael Schumacher in the wet. And he actually shook my hand afterwards, which was, I was in no fit state. I can tell you, I was like absolutely wrecked. I have to cut out of the car after that. And I just thought, I couldn't do that again. Please don't ask me to do that again. But very proud of myself for having done it, because I drove out of my skin in that race and difficult condition.
Isn't it amazing that there are times, there are moments when you're in a car where you just can dig something else out, which actually is not available all the times. You just find something in your bag.
And I just think you hear stories about people in dire situations or very dangerous situations, and they do extraordinary things because they have to drag someone out of a burning building, or they have to lift a car off of some kid or something like that. And somehow
they find that extra strength,
somehow
they
find something. And I think this is it. But I think you can only do it so many times, you know, willingly or forcing yourself to do it. I just think, and I think I peaked. That was my peak. I mean, after that, I did some good laps. I did some good racing, but I don't think I ever drove out of my skin like that ever again. So, you get back. And actually, that's what I needed to do. I needed to find out where the peak was, you know, and that was my peak. So I found that. And from then on, it was, you know, I was never going to get as high as that. That was my K2 moment, you know, literally Everest moment, whatever you want to call it, or landing on the moon moment. I don't know. It was just, it was the peak, and I could never really get back there again, because it needed everything. It's the circumstances that required it as well.
Amazing moments, mate. I can remember it like yesterday. No doubt you can too.
Indeed.
Can you remember it, Dave?
I can.
You remember
the
commentary with Murray?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. It's that sadly, I am old enough to remember that. But it was amazing times.
That said,
hey,
I was going to say
road cars.
Road cars.
Go on.
Listen, I'll just add, because I think sometimes you forget, I saw an onboard of me driving Nick Mason's 250 GTO it was on Twitter, you know, someone retweeted some picture. And I'm watching this and I'm going, okay, who's, oh, it's me driving, you know, it's me driving this car around Goodwood, and like, this steering's going like this, and I'm changing gear, and I'm thinking, blimey, what was I doing? I must have been mad. But anyway, so, you know, it is a case of, you know, racing is a case of seat the pants, isn't it, Jason? You know, you just throw yourself in there and you kind of go, we'll sort it out and we'll try and the instinct, sometimes you're a spectator, an amazed spectator at your own driving, because you can't honestly say you're consciously doing that. It's just simply reaction, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And it's almost, I like to think about it sometimes, it's almost like you're in a trance.
Yeah, definitely.
You're just in a different place.
Yeah.
You know, you're totally focused. You're not really absorbing anything other than what you're doing. And actually, that's really joyous. Yeah.
Well,
really,
you're alluding to what Stirling Moss said, which was, he had a great quote, which was, speed is tranquility. So for him, it's a meditative state.
Yeah.
And, ooh, what was that?
was that your stomach, Jason?
Someone's stolen your car.
Dear God. I think that was
the ghost of Stirling Moss.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. God bless you.
Damon, we started off talking music with you, and Jason and I have always said that music and motoring go well together, so I think this would be an apt point to come out. We need your fantasy drive, please. Where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? And most importantly, what are you in?
You're talking to me.
Yes, that's a question for you.
I bet you're talking to our listeners. I think, are you going to get some people phoning in or something?
No, we need your fantasy.
You didn't mention road cars. Now, I'm really, really sorry. I'm going to massively disappoint you, because I know this is all about cars and stuff. I don't know anything about cars. I honestly, all I know about is driving. All I know about is racing and doing that. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big car person. I don't have.
You could do it on a bike if you want.
Knowledge of yeah, okay. So it's a ride on a bike. Or something like that.
Yeah.
Road trip.
Okay, road trip. Okay. Well,
anywhere in the world,
I will.
Anything you want.
Okay. I'm going to plug something now. But we recently started doing these gourmet grand tours. Okay.
Right.
And I did have a go. Basically, drive around, it was Provence, and we had some fantastic roads going through the mountains, through the Alps, around through the, you know, definitely, well, I can't remember what the name of the road was now, but it was amazing. The scenery in the Alps is stunning. So, some sort of
Route Napoleon.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was, but one of those routes that they do on the Tour de France, you know. And
fun.
And I actually drove a Porsche Carrera 911 with four wheel drive, rear wheel steering.
Yes.
Okay.
That was unbelievable. Because you get those hairpins, it just goes whizzing around the hairpins, doesn't it? So I've not had rear wheel steering, but I know that Michael did in the Benetton. So now I know.
Is that true?
Basically, now I know what it's like.
Brilliant.
I I'd thoroughly recommend it. So rear wheel, yeah. But I'm not. Yeah, I mean, I think it would have to be some of those lovely old cars, you know, with the big gear lever and the throaty engine, probably. Maybe a Ferrari.
What would the soundtrack be then? What would be playing on the 8-track or whatever was in said vehicle?
It'd probably be something like Pink Floyd, Wish You Were Here, or something like that. Some epic track, you know, with a great guitar solo from Dave Gilmour.
Oh, perfect.
Sounds pretty tickety-boo to me.
Perfect, 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 Mr. Plato. And on that note, I think you should take us out.
Well, sadly, that is it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Thank you, Dave, as always. But a huge thanks to our very special guest this week, the one and only Mr. Damon Hill. Thanks, pal. Really enjoyed that.
It's been a great pleasure, Jason. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dave.
No, it's been great. privilege and a pleasure to have you on. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Ta-da!